Welcome to Philosophy and Faith, where our goal is to help you navigate your intellectual and spiritual journey, especially in regards to topics like God, faith and doubt, meaning and purpose, and more. I'm Nathan Beasley.
And I'm Daniel Jepson. And together we discuss the big questions that humans have wrestled with for thousands of years.
We're glad you can join us. Hello, Daniel.
Nathan, good to see you again.
Good to see you again as well. Excited to continue on our conversation from last time.
Yeah.
We're talking about how love is what preceded the universe because God has existed and in an eternal community.
Right.
That we call Trinity. And how the purpose of the creation, the why behind the creation is God's expansive, self-giving love for the good of others. So it's been a lot. It's good to continue to unpack it. Today, we want to talk about something that's uniquely Christian, which is the Christ event,
right?
The incarnation, the arrival of Jesus. We could put it in technical terms or general terms. So anyway, right. So let's talk about the incarnation, how that fits into our understanding of God's love and God's purposes for humanity and creation.
Yeah, let's do that. Just as a reminder from the last episode, we said that the reason God created all things was an act of love. Love being defined as giving of oneself to meet the ultimate needs of the other person. And then we kind of fleshed that out. We looked at John 17 and Ephesians 1 that talked about this. And we talked about the love that existed before creation. And one of the things I was going to mention that I didn't, I was looking at my aquarium today. And I was thinking through some of the things we were talking about. And I'm like, why did I create this aquarium? And part of it was the same reason that we create anything. So whenever you've written a few songs before, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So you write a song, your wife writes poems, now and then, I know. Why do we do that? It's an expression of who we are.
Yeah.
It's an expression of who we are. So I didn't have to create that. I could have had someone else create that aquarium and put it in my office if all I wanted was a pretty scene to look at. But no, I wanted to do it myself because it was an expression of some beauty that I wanted to see.
I mean, it's any time we design a room or we shop for clothes or anything. I mean,
right.
a lot of those are ways in which we kind of express ourselves. The brands we choose, I mean, everything is
yep.
is an expression of the self.
Right. And that's a fundamentally human thing.
Yeah.
If we're made in the image of God, then it probably makes sense that when God creates, it's also an expression of who he is.
Oh, that's a neat thought.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah.
That he is love.
Just thinking, looking outside and seeing the color, especially around springtime.
Yeah.
The beauty of the birds singing and vibrant colors and all that stuff. That's pretty neat to think of that as an expression of God's heart.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, today I want to go a little bit further and we're going to talk about how Christianity gives an answer for that, that also tells us a little bit in broad outline. We may not understand everything, but in broad outline, how God does that.
Okay.
How does God bring this love into this creation? And then how does that love interact with us as humans?
Sounds good. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, the place to start here, I think, is in John chapter 1. So John chapter 1 is fairly well known. I think it's also the philosophically deepest chapter in the entire Bible.
That's a bold statement.
It is. Maybe Genesis 1 would rival that, but I think this even goes beyond that because it's based upon Genesis 1, but it goes, in a sense, deeper.
Okay, so how much am I reading here?
Well, why don't you start just by reading verse 1.
Okay. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God.
All right. And you probably know what the word, translated word, is.
Yeah, that's an uppercase W.
Right.
It's going to talk here in a second about the Word being made flesh. So that's the Logos.
Right. So the Greek word is Logos.
Yeah.
Now, there has been a lot of things written about what Logos means. But primarily, if you look and you research all of that, there are two primary things that this word means, and John is tying them both together here because this Logos, this Jesus, fulfills them both. So in the Old Testament, this word would be used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament for just the word of the Lord. So think of how many times God said, "Thus saith the Lord," or "the Lord says this."
Hmm.
And all those times, the idea is that God is revealing to humanity something about himself, his plan, his purpose for humanity. He is revealing something about him to them that they need to know.
Yeah, that's a lot of times.
Yeah, it is. And especially his heart, about who he is, right? Yeah. So that is one strand. That's one part of this, that when John chooses this word, he's very consciously choosing a word that harkens back to that. But the other strand of that is that this word is also very key in Greek philosophy and thought. Remember, he's writing in the Greek language.
Yeah.
Many of his audience members are going to be those who are thoroughly formed in the Greek culture. Well, pretty much all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're living under Roman rule, but it's really Greek culture.
Yeah. So it's deeply Hellenized.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a deeply Hellenistic culture. And because of that, there is this tradition within intellectual thought, which has influenced, you know, pretty much everybody, that the logos here means something like the first principle or the rational essence of all that there is. Mm. First principle of rationality, first principle of creation or the world, the ultimate rational principle by which all things kind of hold together or consist. So different Greek philosophers would put it different ways. I believe it goes all the way back to Heraclitus. I think he was the first one to use this, the word logos, in a philosophical sense. And that was a long time even before Plato. So it has all that weight on it, that this is the rational principle, the underlying essence of the universe. And that's why, by the way, the word logic is based on logos.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you see that right away. And that's why, because it has that idea within Greek thought. John's taking those two together, and he's saying the ultimate rational purpose or meaning of the universe and the word of the Lord by which he expresses himself and who he is and what he is saying to all mankind is all wrapped up in this person, Jesus of Nazareth. That's an amazing statement.
Wow. Yeah, can I read that one more time?
Yeah.
With that in mind. It says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." So that's, I mean, that's even, you get the union there, the oneness, but you also get the distinction.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's deep.
Right. So he's combining both these, but also saying that this in some way is identified with God, even though it's also distinct from God. So this is a kind of the one of the foundational verses for thinking about the Trinity. So this is what he has in mind. This logos was with God. All things are going to be created through him, as he goes on into the next verses. So he's further described as being the light in this passage. So why don't you go ahead and read verses 9 through 14 of John chapter 1.
Okay, so it says, "The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children born not out of natural descent, nor of human decision or of a husband's will, but born of God. The Word," again, uppercase W, "the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth."
This is an amazing, amazing claim. What John is saying here is that distinct from God and yet equal with God is someone he calls the Logos and the Light. And that this one existed eternally with God. Through him, all things were made, and yet he is able to step into this creation.
Hmm.
So by himself, in his nature, this logos person does not have a body, but he is able to take on this physical body like that we have. And the word he uses there, the word became flesh, Greek word is sark, which just means flesh, just like you and I would have. And that's why it's called the incarnation, because if you go to Latin, carne is flesh.
Yeah.
Just like in many of the Romance languages, chili con carne is chili with meat.
Carne asada, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the same idea. So incarnation means enfleshment of something that was of a person who was not enfleshed before.
So that Christ was with God and was God in the beginning before creation, then becoming made known. So that's why we talk about Jesus as being God in the flesh.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Exactly. So Christ did not exist, did not come into existence when he was conceived.
Exactly. And the Orthodox formulation, very simple, is there was never a time when he was not. And that's going to be difficult for us to understand how that works, but that's Orthodox Christianity right there. So I was reading this lately, and I pulled out my Greek New Testament, and I'm just going to flex here because, hey, I know Greek. Anyway, I was looking up that word where it says in one place that the word became flesh. And then right before that, it talked about how those who receive him become children of God. So they become like God in some way. And that's primarily the emphasis on childhood, I think, in this passage, is that we become united with God, but also are like him. So we become like God, and he became flesh. And I looked it up, and it's the same Greek word. The root of that is genomai, which means to be or become. But I'm thinking, wait, so John is self-consciously putting that same verb together right next to each other. He became flesh, and because he has done that, we are able to become God.
Or like God.
Yeah, we don't become God ontologically, thank you.
Yeah.
But we become children of God. That's what I meant to say.
Yeah.
So obviously, in my mind, he linking those two up, and you know, we talked before about how in one sense we would not say that God is in this universe of becoming. He's in the existence of being. Mm-hmm. And yet here, he enters into this world of becoming so that we can become something that we weren't. He becomes something that he wasn't, in a sense, so that we can become something that we weren't either. And that's a beautiful thought to me.
It's like St. Irenaeus says, he became what we are so that we might become like, or so we might become what he is.
Yes. And you can misread that. Like I said, God has an ontological status as the creator distinct from this universe, and we're not ever going to be that. But in the sense that we become spiritual beings in connection with him and like him in what we value and think and do, that is what I think is involved, and that's a wondrous thing.
Yeah, that's what's the technical term? Deification?
Yeah, but again, I think that...
You don't want to get it mixed up.
That says too much to me, that word.
Really, but we increasingly take on certain attributes of God while never being able to fully take on his attributes that we've talked about in the past.
Right. So we don't become the God, but we become, in a sense, God-like.
Yeah. That's really neat. I could see that as we increasingly grow in knowledge of certain spiritual realities, as we take on the divine characteristic of love, as we go and participate in the realization of his kingdom on earth as it is in heaven, through prayer and through action, it makes sense. But like you said, you got to not take it too far. we don't get brought into the oneness like an Eastern thought.
No, we are not dissolved into God. We are distinct from him and always lesser than him in the ontological sense. But this idea of union and likeness is at the heart. And I think that's why he chooses the phrase children of God. Because children are close, emotionally united with their parent, with their father. And also, especially in the ancient world, the idea was that the child would do what the father was doing. They're going to be like him in that. So 9 times out of 10, if your father was a fisherman, you would be a fisherman also. So that's the idea of likeness of character, likeness of action, and union with God is, I think, what's at the heart of being children of God.
Gotcha.
One other way to talk about this, though, is to think through the two words that the New Testament uses to talk about life. And both of these are applied to human life, one potentially, one that we all have. And those two words are bios and zoe. So bios, we get biology from that. Zoos, we get zoology from that. But we shouldn't get hung up. Those are modern ways that we've attached study to them. That's not the distinction between biology and zoology that is involved in those two words as it's used here. But rather, those two words are used very specifically to talk about a natural kind of life that we're born with and kind of life that is a gift to those who have placed their trust and are following Christ, that he offers to anyone who will receive that in being united with him in that way. So bios life. Basically, it's the life that we share with the animals in which we are self-seeking. We self-seek, we seek our own needs, we seek our own desires, and we live, in that sense, like higher animals. We have rationality, but the goal of our life pretty much is the same goal as the animals. We want security, we want comfort, we want the things to bring us pleasure. Okay. Zoe life is life of a different kind. It's life of a different realm. And that's why, even though they're both translated as life in our English Bibles, the Greek New Testament does not do that. They use different words. He uses bios and zoe. And we're born with bios life, but zoe life is a gift that we can receive. And this is what it's talking about, say, in John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him, whoever places their trust in him, will have eternal zoe. Not bios, we already have that, but this gift of life that we don't yet have. It's the life of the kingdom of God. And eternal, that word there, doesn't just primarily mean duration. It's a quality word, not a quantity word. Literally, it is eons. So life of the age. Some translations will even translate it that way. Life, the zoe of the ages, the life of the age to come is the idea. That there will be a time where this world will be changed. And when that happens, there is this new kingdom of God who comes, new creation, so a new heaven and a new earth. And in that realm will be those creatures made in the image of God who have a zoe type of existence. That is a gift that's now offered, even though we don't receive that gift in its fullness until new creation comes.
So tasted now, consumed later.
Yes.
Yeah. Love that. Yeah. So that's John Stott. Okay, so this is the weird language that we use as Christians about being born again.
Right.
That's kind of what's going on here.
Exactly. So you're born into a new kind of life. You're born into Zoe life.
Okay. So Nicodemus was correctly confused when Jesus said, you got to be born again. He's like, I'm too big to,
yeah,
to go fit back up there and then,
right, exactly,
be born of my mom again. But okay, so you're born physically and then you're born again, or you receive the Zoe gift of life. Is the Zoe gift of life, trying to think through how that relates to the bios life. I mean, the Zoe life, you still have to eat and drink, and to what degree is it physical, or is it just spiritual? Like, how can we think about that?
Yeah, good question, because I think one of the main problems we have thinking about what Christianity is all about is that we think when we hear the word eternal life that's offered to us, we're thinking of bios life that just extends a long time, right?
Yeah.
And that sounds really boring, to be honest. We're just going to go in heaven and live in this disembodied cloud-like existence and not do anything forever, except maybe at worship services. To be frank, I would not want that. That's one of the reasons to understand God's purpose, we have to understand he's not talking about extending this bios life that we have forever. It's a Zoe life. Now, is that material? Yes, it is material. This is a good physical universe that God has created. He does not want to do away with it. He wants to perfect it and remake it. So we will have an existence at least as physical, if not more than what we have now. And the analogy Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 15 says, imagine if you wanted to plant some crop. I'm going to use a tree. He uses wheat, but say if you want to plant you want an acorn tree to grow on your property. How do you do that?
Well, you Yeah, you plant seed.
So do you go to someone else's property that has an oak tree and maybe dig it out of the ground, get a huge equipment, dig this gigantic hole in your yard and bury the tree?
No.
No. Paul says, exactly. So what you do is you plant an acorn. And that acorn dies to its acorn life, but it doesn't disintegrate. There's a continuity and a discontinuity. It discontinues as an acorn, but the continuity is because of that, it has the potential to create an entirely different kind of thing, an oak tree instead of an acorn.
So there's continuity with the essence of what that is and what that can become, but what it is changes forms.
Yes.
So that's the illustration to we are the seed.
Right now.
And the Zoe, the fulfillment of the Zoe life will be like the oak tree.
Exactly.
Wow.
And the oak tree is just as physical. So Paul does not envision that we won't have a physical body, but it will be a fundamentally different kind of physical body.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, again, that's in 1 Corinthians 15 if someone wants to research that. But one analogy I've thought of and I kind of used before, it's almost like through the offer of Christ, because of what he has done, we who are stones, who would naturally just go into the ground and be buried and forgotten, can now become seeds.
Hmm.
And a seed goes in the ground, it's buried, it dies as a seed, but it's raised up as to something entirely different and larger and more beautiful. That's an indication that we will have a physical body, to answer your question. Will we eat and drink and have sex? I don't know. I suspect probably not, at least in the sense that we participate in those things now, but I could be wrong.
Mm. Yeah, one of the metaphors in the last chapter of Revelation talks about the tree that produces fruit in each season. But I mean, to what degree is that literal and
right,
metaphorical? Exactly. I mean, of course, that's a beautiful metaphor for flourishing and not lacking and that kind of thing. But
yeah. C.S. Lewis had a couple good illustrations that I think are worthwhile for us to think through. One of these he called the good infection. And so he wanted to talk about how this new life that Christ has as this perfect human can affect us today. Now, obviously, in one sense, he is the penalty for sin. So there is that theological sense. But how does that work in more of an organic sense? And one of the things he talks about is that we err in thinking that we as humans are discrete individuals that don't affect each other. So we're not, for example, 10 pennies sitting on a table that look alike, but they're discrete. So if I move one, I don't move any of the others necessarily. But instead, he says, think of us as points or branches or leaves on a very large and complex tree. Or think of us like a human body where we are all interconnected. So two pennies sitting on a table look exactly alike almost, but they're not connected. My nose and my lungs don't look alike, but they are connected.
Yeah.
There is this organic unity. So he says, think of a way that if you had a good infection, if you had an antibiotic to some disease that was affecting you, and that started in one place, but eventually it worked its way through this whole body. That's what the incarnation, he says, is doing.
So it's caffeine.
Now you're going to read my illustration, but or his illustration in this case. That's an interesting way of putting it. And he even says, if you look at humanity as this timeline tree, this tree that grows fuller and bushier with time, he even says that the effects can work backwards. And we talked about causation working backwards a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
A couple episodes ago. I don't know. That's hard for us to picture.
Yeah, we can't really conceptualize it, but it's an interesting philosophical thought exercise.
Yeah, it is. It is. And so I think that idea, there's something to that, that what happens when the Logos takes on Sark is that Sark itself is changed. Sark being, again, flesh. Human flesh is changed. It has now the potential to be and to do something that it did not have before. And I don't know if I can explain that, but to me, there's something that happens to the nature of humanity itself when Christ becomes man.
Good.
One other illustration he gives is toy soldiers. Did you ever play with Army Men as a kid?
Oh, yeah.
That was my favorite toy.
G.I. Joes?
Yeah.
But I had been around for a while, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah, I had the little ones. Well, let's go with the G.I. Joe. So you've got a G.I. Joe doll.
Action figure. Please, come on. Not dolls.
So imagine if you've got your 12-inch G.I. Joe action figure.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. And what if you had the power to turn him into a real human? So not only a 12-inch human, but a regular-sized human. Mm. And he does a thought experiment. He says, you know, if someone outside that person had that power to make them, and maybe they could exercise that power, you could see why some might not want to give their consent to that, or why some in the middle of that process would feel like they were being ruined instead.
Mm.
All their plastic is being spoiled.
Yeah, everything that they know.
Everything that they know. Their plastic is being spoiled because it's no longer going to be plastic. It's going to be changed. The world that they're adapted to with their tanks and boats and motorcycles are no longer going to be adequate because now they're different.
Mm-hmm.
And the very materials that they're made of, like we talked about, are going to be changed. You can see that from one perspective, that's a loss of who they were. But in another perspective, it's culmination of something better than they would, better than what they could have imagined. But if you only look at what is lost and what's spoiled, then you understand why sometimes the good news doesn't seem as good as it should to us.
Yeah, because it's outside of our natural framework.
Yes, and we can't really conceptualize the goodness that it will be.
Hmm. Yeah, other than through certain metaphors.
Right. Best we can do.
Yeah, which is scary. Yeah, so C.S. Lewis said toy soldiers, Walt Disney said Pinocchio.
Yeah, there you go.
Wow, that's equal parts beautiful and also kind of scary because there is a transformation process,
mm-hmm.
A metamorphosis, so to speak. There's fear of unknown there for sure. So
there is. Now, last time we talked about how God's ultimate purpose in the universe was love. And that's where I want to come back to as we kind of begin to wrap this up. All this is an act of God by which he offers our ultimate good to be more than we could ever imagine. We don't see that yet, so we have to trust him. But because he's created us with free wills and not automatons that just have to do his bidding, it is still a choice to us. But ultimately, the goal of that is not to create a bunch of good people, not to create a bunch of religious adherents. It's to create a new race of humanity that has a different kind of life, a Zoe life, united with Christ Jesus himself, who is the image of all the heart and the wisdom of God within this universe. It's taking that Trinitarian circle of love and expanding it outward to include us in that way. I heard a good illustration of what this looks like. I don't know if it's a true story or not. It's one of those where if it's not true, it should be.
Yeah.
These soldiers were fighting in France. These American soldiers were fighting in France during World War II, and one of their buddies was killed. And they went to the nearest church that they could find to try to bury him. They went to the priest there because it was a Catholic church, like most churches in France are. And they wanted to bury him in the church graveyard because very often in the old world, their graveyards are right there as part of the church grounds. And the priest said, you know, I'm sorry, but I can't because we have rules that only those who are Catholics can be buried within this Catholic churchyard. And your friend was not a Catholic. And they're disappointed, but they go outside the gate. They go outside the fence of the graveyard and they find a place and they bury him there. Some years later, they come back after the war, 4 or 5 years later, they come back to revisit and process some of their emotions and to honor the grave of their friend that they lost. And they come back. Well, church is still there. Fence is still there. Graveyard is still there. But the stone they put up to mark their buddy's grave is gone. There's no indication that there's any grave at all. And they're really confused. And they go back to the church then and they ask the priest about it. And he said, you know what? Here's what happened, guys. After you left, I began realizing how unjust our rule was, especially in circumstances like these. So what I did was I expanded the fence. I expanded the fence to include your buddy there. I think of that story when I think of God kind of expanding the circle of Trinitarian love to include us in the life of God, as it were, in the love of God. It's an amazing thing to me.
That's beautiful. And it's just so helpful to think through God's not going to force it on us. It is our choice, and it can be a fearful choice because there's a different kind of love and life that we're invited to. But you sharing how it's a different quality of life. God knows what's best for us, and he can give us what's best for us. In fact, he wants to give us what's best for us, and he's given of himself in order to give what's best for us. But we have to choose to surrender to that process.
Just like the caterpillar chooses to surrender to the process by which he or she becomes a butterfly.
Yeah.
Of course, they do it instinctually. We have to make the choice. But yes, the idea.
It's a different quality of life. Again, just going back to the beginning here, the definition, love, giving of itself for the good of another person, trusting that God is the one who can really define that for us.
Yep, exactly.
Is really important here, and especially in light of the other times we've talked about this, like God who has created us, who exists fundamentally differently than us, just categorically different, infinite qualitative difference, trusting that God knows what's best for us and surrendering to his plan and his process is the key here. Thankfully, he's revealed himself, his word, Jesus Christ, to show his plan and his process and his goodwill and good pleasures toward us. It's a beautiful thing.
It is. And can you imagine a humanity? Can you imagine a humanity where instead of seeking our own way to meet our own needs and our own powers, and for the most part, using other people in light of that, where my needs are met by you and your needs are met by mine, and this is true of all humanity, that we're fundamentally oriented to meet the other person's need instead of our own, but we trust that they're able to meet our need because they're also fundamentally oriented that way. That's a different vision of what human life can be like.
Yeah.
It's not just this life extended eternally. It's a butterfly existence as opposed to a caterpillar existence. It's that radical of a change.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, that's all I have for today.
Wow. It's good stuff. Thank you so much.
I hope people think through that a little bit and meditate on its meaning.
Yeah, I know I will be. So thank you.
Yeah. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like what you hear, click follow or subscribe depending on your platform. Check the notification bell so you're up to date with new episodes and leave us a review. Until next time.